This episode of Check the Locks is brought to you by our friends at Audible.
Audible is your one-stop shop for audio entertainment where you can always find the best of what you love or discover something new.
That's right. Audible offers an incredible selection of audiobooks across every genre, from mysteries, thrillers, biographies, and of course, true crime.
And as an Audible member, you can choose one title a month from their catalog to keep forever, including the latest bestsellers and new releases.
Audible members also get access to thousands of podcasts from popular favorites, exclusive new series, and this very podcast you're listening to now.
Plus, the Audible app makes it easy to listen anytime, anywhere. While traveling, working out, walking the dog, doing chores, Audible makes listening anywhere easy.
And best of all, Check the Locks listeners can try Audible for free for 30 days. So head over to audibletrial.com/checkthelocks or click the link in the show notes to start enjoying Audible today.
Warning, Check the Locks podcast is a true crime podcast and may contain graphic descriptions of violence, murder, sexual assault, and more. Check the Locks podcast is not appropriate for all listeners. Listener discretion is strongly advised.
Welcome back to Check the Locks podcast. As always, I'm John Connor.
I'm Olivia Cornu.
Saying thank you for joining us this week as we dive into yet another truly terrifying true crime case. Before we get started, as always, Olivia, it's wonderful to see you. How are you? How was your play this evening?
Oh, my play was wonderful. I went to see Mrs. Doubtfire at the Sanger Theater in New Orleans. It was lovely, hysterical, and really just kept you on your toes.
Was it as good as the movie?
I mean, it's different. It's like more modern day, like the kids are texting and some of it was different. Like the mom was like a clothing designer. And I think in the movie, she's like a architect or some sort of business woman of some sort. She wasn't a clothing designer.
Yeah, I think if I remember correctly, and if you're listening, definitely correct me if I'm wrong, but I think she may have been like some kind of like fancy interior decorator that or something like that. Right.
Something like that, yeah.
Because Pierce Brosnan wants her to basically like take over designing this area for him or whatever. So
yeah, so a lot of the whole storyline is the same. It's just a little different.
Well, I will say, you know, I love that movie. I recently showed it to Millie. And if you're a parent out there and you want to find a great way to have a conversation about what divorce is with a five-year-old, watch Mrs. Doubtfire because it'll spark that conversation. No problem.
No, it was good. That's How was awesome. Your week? How was your weekend?
My weekend was good. It was really busy. Millie had soccer yesterday, scored 5 goals. Whoop, whoop.
What?
Best game she's played since starting soccer. So she crushed. Then we had dinner with friends last night and then family photos today. And then we were putting groceries away and found that we have an ant problem. So in the middle of researching the case for tonight's episode, I had to go to Home Depot and get a bunch of, you know, bug killer and come back and spray the house down and all that stuff. So it's been a lot of running, gunning, a lot of getting stuff done, but it's a late night episode. We're starting this at 10:18. So it's going to have some off the rails energy, which I'm kind of excited about, but I think it'll be a good one. We haven't
had this in a long time.
I know we haven't had like a good late night sesh. And I know you're super pumped about this, but I brought a long one this week. So
yeah. Johnny Boy brought like 12, 13, 14 pages. And I'm on day 7 tomorrow of 7 of work. And I am just spent. But here we are.
Well, we're going to get through it. We're going to do it together. We're going to have a good time. So
lucky
what,
for you, it's your case and not mine.
That's true. And I do want to give a warning. And usually I don't do this, but there are a lot of brutal details in this case. And so I would say, you know, if you are somebody who has a hard time with the graphic descriptions, this may not be the episode for you. So just want to give you a heads up. I know as I was researching it, I was like, whoa, this is kind of a lot. And so I want to make sure I'm putting that out there. And especially if you're someone who has a hard time like me, cases involving children, stuff like that. So again, just wanted to put that out there. Listen at your own risk. We do the disclaimer every week, but just want to put a little something extra on there.
All right. Well, I guess I'm just done for the night then, if it's so graphic and disturbing.
All right. Well, that was this week's episode. We'll see. No, I think we'll be able to hang in, but what do you say? Should we just jump on into it?
I think so.
All right. Let's do it. For this week's case, we're heading to Jefferson County, Indiana. It was a cold winter morning on January 11th, 1992. Don Foley and his brother Ralph had been out quail hunting that morning, and as they walked, they noticed a strange object lying in a soybean field. The pair approached the object and sadly made a gruesome discovery. There were the remains of a charred human body. The victim was wearing panties but was severely burnt from the waist up. Don and Ralph immediately called in their horrifying find to the local authorities. Now, at this time, there hadn't been a homicide in Jefferson County in over 3 years, so the local authorities were skeptical of the call. But when they arrived on the scene, they learned that it was all too real. Detectives got to work on the investigation quickly. They took casts of tire tracks and footprints found in the area. Then they examined the body. Detective Curtis Wells, a forensics expert, immediately noticed some grisly details. First, it appeared that some type of accelerant had been used to burn the body and any potential physical evidence. In fact, a melted plastic bottle containing trace amounts of gasoline was discovered in the weeds near the body. It also appeared that the victim had been sexually assaulted, either before the murder or shortly after. Now, detectives initially believed that the victim may have found themselves in a drug deal gone bad, but there were still too many questions. Like, why leave the body out in the open? There was tall brush nearby, and if the killer had just moved the remains 20 feet, they would have never been discovered. But unbeknownst to the authorities, all of these questions would be answered later that same day. So before we go any further, Olivia, what are you thinking so far? Because for me, I know that would be a horrifying discovery if I was just kind of out walking in the woods. So what do you think?
Yeah, I think that's terrifying. And, you know, as someone who like goes out in nature and like runs and like goes around town and stuff, like I feel like, you know, those people who like check bags like that are on the side of the road.
Yep. Like, yeah. Make sure it's carpet, not a body.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is kind of giving me that kind of vibe.
For sure. Well, should we keep going?
Yeah, I think so.
Alrighty. Well, across town, Clifton and Glenda Lawrence were enjoying a quiet night at home. They were watching TV together when their 15-year-old daughter, Toni, returned. But she was not alone. With her was Toni's best friend, Hope Rippey. Hope's parents, Carl and Gloria, were right behind them, all sporting cold, sober faces. Carl Rippey told Clifton that the girls had claimed to have witnessed a murder. The details seemed spotty, but Carl believed them. Now, in utter disbelief, Clifton asked the Rippies to head to the police station with him, but they declined, stating that they would first need to speak to a lawyer. But Clifton had made up his mind, and he, Glenda, and Toni arrived at the sheriff's department a little after 9 p.m. During questioning, Toni shared that she had been out the night before with two friends, Hope Rippey and 17-year-old Lori Tackett. Toni told authorities that the three girls had driven to Albany and picked up another girl, 16-year-old Melinda Lovelace. Melinda was a friend of Lori's, and Toni shared that she had never met Lovelace before. Now, after picking up Melinda Lovelace, the four girls headed to a punk rock show. Toni informed police that the girls had stayed for a few hours before heading back home. And during the car ride, Melinda Lovelace began informing the other girls of some romantic troubles. According to Lovelace, she had been dating a girl named Amanda, but things went sour when Amanda began seeing another young woman. According to Melinda Lovelace, her name was Shonda, and Lovelace wanted her dead. After collecting Toni's statement, the Lawrence family was leaving the police station, and it was around that time that a missing persons report came in. And what it read made the sheriff's heart sink. The missing girl was 12-year-old Shonda Scherer. Now, Shonda Scherer was a small girl. She was roughly 5 feet tall and around 100 pounds. Shonda had blonde hair and was known for being quite the bubbly child. But sadly, Shonda's description was a match to the sheriff's Jane Doe. And when the dental records came back only a short time later, the sheriff's worst fears were confirmed. His Jane Doe was, in fact, Shonda Scherer. Now the authorities had the heartbreaking task of informing Shonda's parents. Now, at first, Jackie Vaught and Stephen Scherer were happy to hear from the police. They assumed that their daughter had been out with friends and had just yet to return. But when they saw the look on the detectives' faces, they knew something was wrong. And in an instant, their world was shattered. And Jackie broke down hysterically. But by this time, police had already begun the process to obtain arrest warrants for Melinda Lovelace and Lori Tackett. Additionally, Tackett's vehicle had been seen at the Lovelace home, so the authorities could make both arrests at once. And at a little over 2 a.m., detectives arrived at the Lovelace home. Melinda's mother, Margie, answered the door. After explaining why they were there, Margie told the officers that the girls were upstairs in Melinda's room. And when they entered the bedroom, both were found sleeping peacefully. Detectives shouted for the girls to get up, and as they were opening their eyes, they were placed in cuffs and arrested for Shonda's murder. Now, as the girls were being arrested, the autopsy results were coming back. And those results, again, were shocking. Shonda Scherer had suffered multiple injuries. Ligature marks were found on her neck and wrists, and she had suffered several lacerations to the head. Shonda's fingers were broken and distorted, and in order to get fingerprints, they had to be physically removed. Shonda's upper body was covered in third and fourth degree burns, and lacerations to the anus and rectum indicated that she had been sexually assaulted with a blunt object. But most horrifyingly, soot was found inside Shonda's lungs. This meant that the 12-year-old had been set on fire while she was still alive. Now, Melinda and Lori were both questioned before they were transported. Both girls were charged with one count of murder, and in an arraignment hearing, a judge determined that due to the violent nature of the crime, the girls would be charged as adults. Now, by this time, like with most cases of this magnitude, the media had become aware of the case and it was making national headlines. And because of this, several teenagers saw the story and came forward with additional information. Apparently, Lovelace and Tackett had confessed to what they had done to at least three other teens. Detectives also spoke to Hope Rippey's attorney. But one thing was clear. Each of the four girls seemed to downplay their involvement. But their stories seemed to match. And as more and more information began to come in, what happened to Shonda in her final hours started to become clear. So before I go any further, Olivia, because I saw you making some faces as we were going through, tell me where your head's at. What are you thinking?
Well, my first thought was I didn't think that they were that young. Like 12 is really young. And then to say that one of them has a car, they seem like a wide range of girls to be hanging out with each other, especially to be romantically involved. I can't imagine that these young girls would do this to someone so young.
Yeah, it's
kind of shocked by the whole thing.
Yeah, it's really intense, especially as you go through. And like I said, like disclaimer, right? Because what happens is very graphic, but to think as we're going through this, that it's being done by children, essentially
children,
The oldest is 16, 17 years old. It's, it's really sad.
And girls at that, I know we've done the case where the best friends killed the friend, but like, this just seems like overkill. And we haven't had a case like that in a while.
No, not at all. And again, I think as we go through, I think you're going to be really surprised at the level of brutality among children. Cause it's kind of crazy.
Yeah. Well, we should keep going.
Well, detectives learned that on Friday, January 10th, 1992, Melinda Lovelace had finally had enough. Her girlfriend, 14-year-old Amanda, had been fooling around with Shonda, and Lovelace was going to do something about it. She also knew that Lori Tackett would be happy to help her enact her plan. See, Tackett was kind of an outcast. She dabbled in the occult and would claim to have another personality that was a, quote, vampire. But to Loveless, she was a friend who would do anything for her. And the pair had actually talked about killing someone in the past. Now, on the way to Loveless's home, Tackett stopped to pick up Hope Rippey and Tony Lawrence. And once they arrived at Melinda's home, the girls began chatting about the night's events. It was then that Loveless pulled a large kitchen knife from her purse, telling the other girls she had someone to scare. Loveless had gotten a hold of Shonda's address, and the girls drove to her house. As they drove, Melinda gave instructions. Rippey and Lawrence had never met Cher, so they were going to go to the door and claim to be friends of Amanda. They would tell Shonda that Amanda wanted to meet in hopes of luring her out. Now, when Rippey and Lawrence actually did approach the door, Shonda answered, but she told them that she couldn't leave right that moment because her parents were still awake. But if they came back around midnight, she could sneak out in hopes of meeting Amanda. When Rippey and Lawrence returned to the car, Loveless was furious that they arrived empty-handed. But her spirits lifted when she was told they were coming back in just a few hours. It was then that the four girls got into the car and went to the punk rock show to kill time before returning to Shonda's home. Now, shortly after 12:30 a.m., the girls pulled back into the neighborhood. And this time, Shonda was ready to go. They told Cher that Amanda was waiting to meet her at an old stone building in the woods nearby. It was called the Witch's Castle. As the girls walked back with Shonda, Loveless hid in the back seat. And while hidden away, Shonda entered the vehicle, sitting in the passenger seat. As they drove, Rippey asked Shonda about her relationship with Amanda. And Shonda claimed that they had been seeing each other for quite some time and that she cared deeply for the girl. And it was then that Melinda Loveless pounced up from the back seat. She grabbed Shonda by the hair and held the kitchen knife to her throat. Shonda cried and begged not to be hurt, but Loveless continued to belittle her. By the time the girls reached the wooded area near the witch's castle, Shonda was crying uncontrollably. Loveless held her arms tight as the other girls used lighters to follow the path to the old stone building. Once inside, the girls bound Shonda's hands and removed her jewelry. Hope Rippey seemed to like a musical Mickey Mouse watch Shonda was wearing, so she took it for herself, taunting the girl by playing the watch's music over and over. Tackett then took an old t-shirt and used it to start a fire, illuminating the dark building in the woods. Tackett then told Shonda that she would look like the burned t-shirt before the night was over. But the girls began to grow nervous. They noticed several cars passing and were afraid that they would be seen. So Tackett suggested that they move their murderous plan to another location near her home. So again, they loaded back in the car, Shonda still bound. On the way, they stopped at a local gas station. Shonda was thrown to the floor and covered with a blanket. Tackett pumped the gas while Hope Rippey went inside to pay. But Tony Lawrence made a phone call to a friend. And in that call, she made no mention of the 12-year-old that she was keeping prisoner. This highly contradicted her later claims of being frightened by the evening's events. Once the group was back in the car, they drove roughly an hour to Madison, Indiana. And a few miles after passing Tackett's home, the group turned off on an old logging road. Hope Rippey and Tony Lawrence got out of the car, while Melinda Loveless and Lori Tackett yanked Shonda from the vehicle. Loveless untied Shonda's hands and ordered her to remove her clothing, leaving her freezing and sobbing on that cold January night. In fact, it was so cold that Rippey and Lawrence returned to the vehicle and watched the events unfold from the car's window. Then, Lori Tackett held Shonda's arms behind her back, and Melinda Loveless began brutally beating the girl. After each blow, Shonda promised to stay away from Amanda, but Loveless didn't care. She continued to punch the girl until she collapsed on the ground. Then, Melinda Loveless tried to slit Shonda's throat. But the knife was too dull to cut the skin, and when that didn't work, Hope Rippey and Tony Lawrence exited the car. They proceeded to hold Shonda down while Tackett and Loveless began stabbing her in the chest multiple times. However, the wounds weren't severe enough to kill her immediately, and Lori Tackett decided that they would need to strangle the 12-year-old, so she ran back to the vehicle to retrieve a piece of rope. And as Shonda begged for her life, Melinda Loveless only laughed coldly in her face. Loveless then sat on her legs as Tackett mounted her chest. She wrapped the rope around the girl's neck and pulled until her body went limp. Now, assuming that Shonda was dead, the four girls loaded the body into the trunk and they headed back to Lori Tackett's home. Once they arrived, the group went upstairs to Tackett's room as if nothing had happened. There, Lori pulled out stones in hope of telling the girls' futures. And just as she had finished her reading and telling the three others that they would be safe, the girls heard Tackett's dogs barking. And when they listened closely, they could hear Shonda Scherer's muffled screams from the trunk. Tackett shot up and went to the kitchen, grabbing a paring knife. She then walked outside of the car, opened the trunk, and began brutally stabbing Shonda again. When she was done, she closed the trunk and returned to her room, covered in blood. She told the others that they needed to go for another ride. But this time, Hope Rippey and Tony Lawrence refused to go. So Melinda Loveless and Lori Tackett hit the road together again. And as they drove around, deciding what to do next, they stopped to see if Shonda was dead. And when they opened the trunk, she shot up, trying to say mommy. It was then that Tackett reached into the trunk and retrieved a tire iron. She violently struck Shonda in the head, and again, her body went limp. The girls closed the trunk and continued on their way. Now, at this point, the sun was coming up, so the two girls returned to Tackett's home to wake the others. They told Rippey and Lawrence that they had a new plan, and the four girls headed to Tackett's burn pile. But what they weren't expecting was the pile to be frosted over from the cold winter weather. And this is when Lori Tackett decided to show Rippey and Lawrence what she had done. She again opened the trunk, and to everyone's surprise, Shonda again slowly sat up, rocking back and forth. Now, it's believed that this is when the girls sexually assaulted Shonda using the tire iron. However, none of the four girls has ever admitted to it. After, they made another decision. It was time to end the evening's events and Shonda's life for good. And they still agreed that burning the body was the best option. They piled back into the car and headed for another local gas station, this time buying a 2-liter of soda. The girls emptied the drink and filled the plastic container with gasoline. And once they were back in the car, they again pulled off onto an old logging road. And this is where they found the soybean field. Tackett opened the trunk as Loveless and Rippey removed the body using a blanket. Hope Rippey then took out the gasoline and poured a significant amount on Shonda's body. Lori Tackett then lit a match, setting Shonda Scherer ablaze. The girls again piled back into the car and, hungry from their murderous evening, stopped at McDonald's for breakfast.
This is so gruesome and brutal. And poor Shonda, she's been through hell and back. Literally, like, she's, every time they do something to her, she comes right back and she is fighting for her life. And to see that they just keep going at it instead of just stopping and being like, you know what, I'm so sorry, we can work this out. They just continue to go. I'm just baffled by the amount of brutality by these young women.
Yeah, and I'm with you. Like, at any time during the evening when they realized that they hadn't killed her,
they could have stopped.
Yeah, it wasn't too late. You know, and especially with Lori Tackett, it definitely seems like, you know, we'll talk about it more at the end, but it definitely seems like she was enjoying what was happening throughout the evening and almost like taking pride in what she was doing. Which, yeah. Again, when you think about a group of, you know, 12 to 16, 17-year-old girls, like, it's insane. It's so hard to wrap your brain around that, like, children could do this.
Not what we were doing at our slumber parties when I was that age.
No, not at all. Now, after investigators had put all the pieces together, it didn't take long for charges to be filed against Hope Rippey and Tony Lawrence. Both girls were charged with murder, arson, battery with a deadly weapon, aggravated battery, criminal confinement, and intimidation. But in April of 1992, Tony Lawrence accepted a plea deal. And because of this, she agreed to testify against Ripley, Tackett, and Loveless. Tackett and Loveless were brought up on death penalty charges in July of 1992. Now, on August 17th, Tony Lawrence was found slumped over in her jail cell. She had overdosed on lorazepam, or, you know, what you might know today as Ativan, I think it is.
Ativan, yeah.
And it was later learned that she had been saving her doses in hopes of completing suicide. However, she would end up surviving. And after a stint in a psychiatric hospital, she was transferred back to jail. Now, eventually, Lori Tackett and Melinda Loveless would take a plea deal and escape the death penalty. Both would be sentenced to 60 years in prison. Hope Rippey would maintain her innocence and go to trial. She was originally sentenced to 50 years in prison, but that was dropped to 35 after an appeal. However, all four girls would be released early. Tony Lawrence in 2000, Hope Rippey in 2006, Lori Tackett in 2018, and Melinda Loveless in 2019. But in a strange twist, Melinda managed to turn her life around. While in prison, Loveless signed up for the Indiana Canine Assistance Network. Now, through this program, which they call ICANN, Loveless helped to train dogs who would be used as service animals for people with disabilities. And she was touted as one of the program's best trainers. Through ICANN, Loveless learned the value of life and how to give back to her community. And in an even stranger turn of events, Jackie Vaught, Shonda's mother, learned about Loveless's work through an ICANN breeder. This breeder also happened to be a burn victim. Now, in the past, Vaught has gone on record saying that Loveless was an empty person with nothing behind the eyes. But when she saw a video of Melinda Loveless training with ICANN, she was taken aback, saying that Loveless looked like someone who had been reborn. And as a way of honoring her daughter, Vaught donated a dog to the program named Angel, a dog that Loveless would later train. "She helped me to actually heal, forgive, and grow, whether she wanted that or not," Loveless said of the gesture. "She did a good thing. I would thank her. I couldn't thank her enough." So, Olivia, that's this week's case. What are you thinking? Walk me through it.
I mean, I've said it before. I'm just so shocked by what these young women have done. I'm even more shocked that they all got out of prison. And so early on, I mean, one was it was 92 to 2000. 92 to 2006. I mean, like, they spent a decent amount of time in there, especially the one that made it all the way to 2019. But as bad and as gruesome as this story is, I like the ending. You know, you always hope that people committing these terrible crimes actually have some sort of reform and, like, turn their lives around and can actually be decent people. And so I hope that Loveless continues to do right in the world, because I think she has a lot of good tasks to make up for what she just did to this poor child, Sharna. But I don't know. It's kind of a shocking one. What are your thoughts on this?
Yeah. I mean, I'm right there with you. I mean, especially, you know, being a father, right? Like, this is a parent's worst nightmare.
A regular 12-year-old slumber party, 12 to 16.
Yeah. You know what I mean? And, like, you know, even now, right? Like, my kid's about to finish pre-K and is getting ready to go into kindergarten and stuff like that, right? Like, there's kids already where I'm like, we're not hanging out with them outside of school. You know what I mean? So it's, and, like, it's nothing against the kid, but, like, you know, you see parents and stuff like that, and you're just like, yeah, you know, no. Like, also too, like, sleepovers. Like, my kid is not staying the night at anybody's house.
Okay, like, you got to get over that. She can spend the night. She'll be just fine.
Yeah, I don't think so, man. I don't think I'm getting over that. Me and Kara are both pretty, like, nope.
not anymore.
No, you've got cousins, you've got family, you got people that like I know you can go have sleepovers with, and like I feel safe with that. But if it's like I want to stay at Becky's house, I'm like, I don't know Becky's mom or dad. You know what I mean? So that's not happening. But
does Becky have a paring knife?
Right.
Or a car?
Yeah. So just thinking about it from a parent's perspective, like I can't imagine losing a child and then losing a child in such a brutal way. And then again, I think it's just the age of these kids, right? To think like, and I don't know. I don't know if maybe like once they got into prison, like the reality of what they had done had hit them and maybe they really did change as people. And, you know, as a 16-year-old kid, like you just don't really understand the full spectrum of what happens when you do something. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know. I'm with you though. I felt kind of bad as I was going through and researching this case, because normally like I like to know about the victim. When we do these cases, mm-hmm. we talk about the killers, but I really try to talk about like the victims and, you know, kind of spotlight who they were, because those are the people that are remembered by the family members. And there wasn't really a lot. And so getting to the end and being like, oh, there was like something, you know what I mean? Something of just the slightest good came out of this. You know what I mean? So I don't know. It's been a while, I think, since we've done one like this, where it's just been like, oh man, that was a lot. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I agree.
Well, if we're talking deadbolt test, where are you putting this one?
A 9. And I don't think I have to explain. It's terrifying. Are you being out your, I mean, I've been a 12-year-old girl before, and having your girlfriends all spend the night, or you go spend the night at your girlfriend's house. And, you know, there's always a little bit of catty drama with girls. You'll see real soon once Millie's a little bit older, but there's always a little something, you know, somebody's always a jab at somebody, but like to take it to the extremes in which they took it, that is just, I mean, it's a 9. I don't think I have to explain myself.
No, I'm right there. What about you? I'm right there with you. And it's one of those things too, where, you know, I know you said like, you'll see it like soon enough, but there's a little girl that my kid goes to school with that, you know, she was playing with another little boy. And this girl was like, Millie, you have to play with me. I'm your only BFF. You can't have other BFFs but me. And she'll tell her like, you have to wear this necklace to school tomorrow. Like, so it's, you know, it's already at a very young age. You see some of that stuff, you know, and I mean, I'm with you. This is a 10 for me across the board, 110%. Like I can't, again, just going through it. The closest I can think is like, I remember doing the Texas Candyman episode.
Yeah.
And be like, there's so many victims. And with this, it was that same kind of feeling, but in a, like a different way where I was just like,
this is just so many crimes.
Yeah. Where you're almost like, this is almost too much.
Yeah, I was like, every time they like try to do something to her, she would survive, and they would do something worse and something worse and something worse.
Yeah. And it's that like you had the opportunity, like you had the opportunity to stop this at any time and you didn't. And that's, I think, is one of like the most heartbreaking things about it. So.
Yeah. Most definitely a doozy, John.
I definitely agree. And that is where we fall in the deadbolt test. Olivia's putting it at a 9. I'm coming in at a 10, hitting them double digits. But as always, we want to hear from you, from the listeners, from the locksmiths. Where does the murder of Shonda Scherer fall on your deadbolt test? You can let us know. Reach out to us on Instagram, Check the Locks Pod. You can find us on Twitter, Check the Locks. If you're not in our Facebook group, what are you doing? Come hang out with us. We'd love to get to know you, get to spend a little bit of time with you. And Olivia, obviously, as we have both discussed, right, this was a hard-hitting case. I think it has emotionally drained us to a certain extent. So I don't know about you. I could use, you know, a palate cleanser, pick me up in an emotional woo-ha. What do you got? You got a 5-star review for us? Anything like that?
You know, I have 2 reviews, and these come from Spotify. And the first one comes from Sarah Fortune about the case Something to Chew On, which was the cannibal train crash, which if our listeners don't remember, it's the one where the victim or the guy was walking around like waving the body part around after the train crash and eating it.
Yeah, chewing on it. Yeah, it's
yeah.
Hard to forget.
Yeah. So Sarah said, I think this guy knew the victim and witnessed the wreck because of mental illness mixed with substance abuse. This was his response due to trauma, which is actually a very valid point, Sarah.
Yeah.
With that case, for sure.
I mean, 100%, that could definitely be it. I know that's one of the ones that we have on our revisit list. You know what I mean? You know, people deal with trauma differently. I've gone through traumas in my life. I haven't eaten anyone, but, you know, I'm also not on like a crazy amount of drugs or anything like that. So I think it's a very, you know, valid possibility. But I know you said two. What else you got for us?
Well, the second one comes from Kiana Simpson 25. And this one's about the funeral frauds episode.
I remember.
Where they were, you know, cremating and just kind of like mixing remains up.
Getting dirt, but Kiana sawdust said, and stuff.
Right. Kiana said, I try so hard not to laugh because these stories are so sad, but John cracks me up.
Oh,
John cracks me up too, Kiana.
Thank you, Kiana. Thank you, Olivia.
So yeah, this week we had two. That was really a nice little way to end our gruesome episode.
Yeah, definitely. I completely agree. And also, right, we are running low on those Apple Podcast reviews too. So if you're listening, you have not left us a review, do us a favor, go ahead and do that. And Olivia, if somebody wants to have that review read on the show, what is the best way for them to do that?
They need to go to the Apple Podcast app, go to our show's homepage, scroll down where you see all five of those purple stars, and you need to click them all, highlight them up, and leave us a little bit of love.
That's right. And every week, Olivia says it best, so I don't have to. Apple Podcast, click the stars, leave the review. You know what to do. We'd love to hear from what you think about the show. And Kiana, Sarah, if you are listening, you follow us on Instagram, you know, reach out to us, Check the Locks Pod. You can hit us up on Twitter, Check the Locks. If you're in our Facebook group, reach out there, or you can send us an email. If you're not a social person, hit us up. That's contact@checkthelockspod.com. We would love to get you out some stuff. Thank you for taking the time to leave us those Spotify comments. And again, just helping us grow, right? Getting us out there. And we want to hear what you think about these episodes. So we really do appreciate it. And as always, if you like what we do here at Check the Locks, you want to help us keep the lights on, you can do so by becoming a patron. Head over to patreon.com/checkthelocks. Get signed up today. We got a lot of great tiers. We got stickers, t-shirts, coffee mugs, all stuff that you can only get for being a patron. Plus, you get the episodes commercial free. So if you love Check the Locks, but you hate those ads, Patreon is the way to go. So again, that's patreon.com/checkthelocks. Get signed up today. And if you can't financially support the show, we definitely understand. Just listening and sharing what we do with your friends and family, the people who are important to you, means just as much, if not more. So if that is you, you're listening, you're sending those links, you're telling people to check out the show, just know we appreciate you more than we can tell you. Again, it's that grassroots growth. We're just trying to get more people into our community, more listeners, and just extend our family. And you sharing what we do helps tremendously. So again, from the bottom of our hearts, we appreciate you so very much. That is all that we have for this week's case, but please make sure that you are subscribed to Check the Locks on your favorite podcast app so that you never miss an episode. We will see you again next week with another truly terrifying true crime case, but until then, don't forget to
check the locks.
See you next week.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient, comfortable.